The Royal Institute of Philosophy annual lecture has been given by Tom Nagel and by Alistair McIntyre, Mary Warnock, Bernard Williams, John Searle, Jürgen Habermas, Noam Chomsky, and John McDowell. Jerry Fodor of Rutgers University is more than a worthy successor. He can be counted on, perhaps, to correct, well, a mere inexactitude or two of one of his countrymen who preceded him, a countryman whose identity now escapes me. Folk psychology, as many of you will know, is contrasted with what the users of the term are inclined to call real psychology. Folk psychology, by another estimate, can seem to contain at least some of what we actually know about the conscious mind. I have a word to say for it, as you will gather. There is also the science of the mind, notably cognitive science, and indubitably it adds to our knowledge in more ways than one. Jerry Fodor has resolutely given places to both of those sets of facts and indeed values. And in doing so, with respect to the folk psychology, he has not fallen into the dualism that is better called a spiritualism. And with respect to the science of the mind, he has not fallen into that orthodoxy which is a devout physicalism. He has written, as many of you will know, all of you will know, of the language of thought, which gives a true account of the nature of representation with respect to the human mind and the modular nature of the mind and a number of other large subjects. It is a singular pleasure to ask him to give the Royal Institute of Philosophy annual lecture under the title The Revenge of the Given. There will be questions when we finish.
Well, thank you for the kind introduction and for the invitation. I don't know who you all are, but this is just going to be a philosophy lecture. I mean, nothing exciting or anything. It is perfectly all right not to turn off your cell phones and things of that sort. You want to talk to one another, smoke, whatever you like. The paper it's a fragment of a work in progress, of which I think being in progress is turning out to be an essential property. But this is a little bit plucked from it. I think it's more or less self-explanatory, so I won't go on with introductory material. I'll just read it, and then if you'd rather ask questions or talk about something else or whatever, that's fine. Could there be unconceptualized mental representations? Well, I'm glad you asked. What would they be like? Where might one look for some? How would you know if you'd found one? I think these questions are, in the long run, largely empirical, but liming the landscape that they occupy is a philosophical enterprise within the meaning of the act, and that I shall presently try to do. I also propose to push at them and prod at them until they're in a form where psychological data can be seen to bear, and to say something, only a very little bit, about how the relevant data have been coming out so far. For present purposes, I assume without argument that there are conceptualized mental representations. This assumption is the backbone of the so-called representational theory of mind, which is, of course, itself famously tendentious. But I'm too old to worry about what to do if RTM isn't true. In fact, I'm too old even to take early retirement if it isn't true. So I'm just going to take it for granted. I shall also assume what may be less familiar, namely that conceptualized representation is representation as, and vice versa. So, in particular, mentally represent Mr. James as a cat. Mr. James is the feline locally in currently in residence in Janet and my apartment, and he will be invoked from time to time as something to serve as a subject of a hypothetical discourse. So to represent Mr. James as a cat is to represent him as falling under the concept cat, and to represent Mr. James as falling under the concept cat is to represent him as a cat, and thinking of Mr. James as a cat requires applying the concept cat to Mr. James. All that stuff I'm not going to argue for. This is, to be sure, just the sort of intellectualist kind of thinking of, that mid-century logical behaviorists, notably Ryle and Wittgenstein, said that psychology and the philosophy of mind could profitably do without. Well, they were wrong. If that's all granted, it suggests a first move. We have the option of exchanging, can there be unconceptualized mental representation for, can there be mental representing without mental representing as? This serves to locate the present concerns in relation to a family of others that are philosophically familiar. For example, represents X is transparent to substitution of coextensive noun phrases at the X position, but represents X as F is opaque to substitution of coextensive predicates at the F position. If a token of that cat represents that cat, and if that cat is Granny's favorite cat, then the token of that cat represents Granny's favorite cat. But though a token of that cat represents that cat as that cat, it doesn't follow that that cat represents that cat as Granny's favorite. Take-home exercise, put in the quotation marks. Not even if that is the cat that Granny prefers to every other. In this respect, the semantical distinction between representing and representing as works pretty much like the psychologist's distinction between seeing and seeing as. You can see that cat without seeing it as that cat or as a cat. You can do that, but you can't see that cat without seeing it as a cat. Good. You can't see that cat without seeing it as a cat. That's all implicit in RTM, representational theory of mind, according to which seeing X only requires mentally representing X somehow or other, but seeing X as F requires applying to X the mental representation that expresses the concept F. That's essentially why seeing as is opaque and seeing is transparent. Seeing requires representation, seeing as requires representation as, or so I'm going to assume. So then, it's part of RTM that if there is seeing without seeing as, then there is non-conceptualized seeing. Piety recommends a more traditional formulation. If there is seeing without seeing as, then there is a perceptual given. In what follows, I'll often put the matter the second way, but with a caveat. I assume, contrary to a main epistemological tradition, that the given may be both subpersonal and encapsulated, which is to say that it may be neither conscious nor, in Steve Stitch's term, inferentially promiscuous. This is, to be sure, the thin edge of a complicated tangle of issues. It's arguable, for example, that the content of a representation can't be alienated from its accessibility to consciousness. That might be because, in the case of perceptual judgments or quite generally, the connection between content and the first-person justification of belief is inalienable. And it's also arguable that the connection between content and inferential role is likewise intrinsic because content is itself taken to be a construct out of inferential role. On that sort of view, the notion of a kind of mental representation that's given rather than inferred and that's unconscious to boot, is doubly a contradiction in terms. Discussions of unconceptualized content in the philosophical literature, like, come to think of it, discussions of practically everything else, routinely beg both the question whether the identity of a mental representation is dissociable from its role in inference, and the question whether the intentionality of a mental state is dissociable from its accessibility to consciousness. Speaking just for myself, I see no reason why, for example, the very same mental content that is de facto proprietary to encapsulated processes of visual form perception in one mind might not be available to mechanisms of conscious problem solving in another mind or in the same mind at a different time. In effect, the received philosophical view has it that conceptual atomism, a doctrine I favor, fails to recognize that the content of a representation supervenes on its inferential role, and computational psychology, an undertaking I favor, fails to recognize that mental states are ipso facto epistemologically transparent. Well, maybe, but I wouldn't bet much on either, and I wouldn't be flustered if the given flouts both. Some of this will recur at the end of this talk. Okay, so much for introduction. Kinds of representations. For reasons I'll presently set out, I think there probably are non-conceptual perceptual representations. The line of argument I'll have on offer goes like this. On the one hand, it's empirically plausible that some perceptual representation is iconic, and on the other hand, it's in the nature of iconic representation to be non-conceptual. That being the proposed polemical strategy, I better say now something about what I mean by iconic representation, so turn briefly to that. First then, my usage is idiosyncratic, or at least I think it is. In the semantics and semiotics literature, iconic frequently comports with notions like, for example, pictorial and continuous. But it's not always clear just what any of these comes to, or just what the connections between them are supposed to be. As often as not, they're made to take in one another's wash. For the moment, I propose to pretend the slate is blank and just stipulate. So, first, iconic and discursive in my usage are mutually exclusive modes of representation. That a representation is either entails that it's not the other. I leave it open that some kinds of representation are neither iconic nor discursive. Offhand, I can't think of a good candidate, but it doesn't matter for the present purposes. Second, I assume for familiar reasons that all kinds of representations are concerned, all the kinds of representations we're concerned with are compositional. To a first approximation, a representation is compositional if and only if its syntactic structure and semantic content are both determined by the syntactic structure and semantic content of its parts. So compositionality is required by any serious theory of linguistic and or mental representation because both thought and language are productive and systematic, and that's intelligible only on the assumption that they are compositional. I suppose everybody knows this story, so I won't elaborate, though, just as an aside, I've been devoting a lot of time for the last 5 or 10 years to arguing what I think is right, that the compositionality constraint is the central problem for a theory of content, roughly speaking, to satisfy, and that it's so hard to satisfy that that there's only one of the known theories that meets it. Turns out, fortunately, to be the one I'm in favor of, and it provides knockdown arguments against views that have been widely held, like, for example, that the meaning of an expression consists, at least for some expression, of rules for its application, since it turns out that rules for application don't compose. However, that's all on the side. It's a different lecture. If anybody wants to talk about it at the end, I'll be glad to be given the opportunity. So, so much for iconic representations for the moment. Discursive representations. The sentences of natural languages are the paradigms. Here again, the outline is familiar. Every expression is a finite arrangement of constituents that are themselves primitive or complex. Each complex constituent is a finite arrangement of lexical primitives, words, near enough. Lexical primitives have their syntactic and semantic properties intrinsically. Roughly, a word is a triple consisting of a bundle of orthographic or phonological features, a bundle of syntactic features, and a bundle of semantic features. Actually, I don't believe a word of that, but it'll do for present purposes. These feature bundles are enumerated by the word's entry in the lexicon of the language, all in shutter quotes. A discursive representation in L, language L, is syntactically compositional if and only if its syntactic analysis is exhaustively determined by the grammar of L together with the syntactic analysis of its lexical primitives. Correspondingly, a discursive representation is semantically compositional if and only if its semantic interpretation is exhaustively determined by its syntax with, is exhaustively determined by its syntax together with the semantic interpretations of its lexical primitives. Consider, for example, the sentence, John loves Mary. Its syntactic structure, according to just the standard treatment, is something like John's a noun, loves is a verb, Mary's a noun, loves Mary is a noun phrase, John's a noun phrase, the whole thing's a sentence. Some sort of story like that about the syntax. And its semantic interpretation is more or less that John loves Mary. The syntax and semantics of the sentence are determined by such facts as that Quote, John is a noun and denotes John. That, quote, loves is a verb and denotes the relation X loves Y. And that, quote, Mary is a noun and denotes Mary. Further details are available upon applications upon application at your local Department of Linguistics, but for present purposes, they're not, none of them are tendentious. What matters for us is this. The semantic interpretation of a sentence, and mutatis mutandis of any discursive representation, depends exhaustively on the way the properties of its lexical primitives interact with the properties of its constituent structure. By constituent structure, I mean something like parsing into phrases or something. And not every part of a discursive representation is ipso facto one of its constituents. So, for example, John, Mary, and loves Mary are among the constituents of John loves Mary, according to the standard analysis. But John loves isn't, and nor is the discontinuous sequence John dot 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 Mary. This is part and parcel of the fact that neither the semantic interpretation of, quote, John loves, nor the semantic interpretation of, quote, John dot 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 Mary, neither of those contributes to determining the semantic interpretation of the sentence. In fact, neither of them has a semantic interpretation in that sentence, though, of course, each of the lexical primitives they contain does. I'll say, just to have a way of talking, the constituents of a discursive representation are those of its parts that are recognized by its canonical decomposition. According to me, it's having a canonical decomposition. I'm sure the next page continues this one. Yeah. It's having a canonical decomposition that distinguishes discursive representations from iconic ones. So, iconic representations. Pictures are paradigms, but see the caveats to follow. I suppose that pictures like sentences have a compositional semantics. Their principle of compositionality is this, what I'll call the picture principle. If P is a picture of X, then the parts of P are pictures of parts of X. That's what I'll call the picture principle. Pictures and the like differ from sentences and the like in that icons don't have canonical decompositions. They have interpretable parts, but they don't have constituents. Or if you prefer all the parts of a particular of a picture, so, say that again, or if you prefer all the parts of a picture are ipso facto among its constituents. Icons are compositional according to the picture principle, whichever way you carve them up. Take a picture of a person, cut it into parts wherever you like. Each picture part pictures a person part. And the whole that you have if you reassemble all the picture's parts is a picture of the whole person that the parts are pictures of parts of. Is that transparently clear? If not, I won't read it again. Is that okay? So let me say again. The whole that you have if you reassemble all the picture's parts is a picture of the whole person that the parts are pictures of parts of. That's a consequence of the picture principle. So then, in everything that follows, a representation that has no canonical decomposition is an icon. I'll argue quite soon now that having a canonical decomposition is a necessary condition for is a necessary condition for a representation to be conceptualized. Hence, that the question we started with, are any mental representations unconceptualized, can be swapped for the question, are mental representations iconic? And that, finally, is a question on which empirical evidence can be brought to bear. Iconicity and individuation. So far, iconic representations are typically semantically evaluable, that is, they're typically of this or that, but they have no canonical decompositions, which is to say they have no constituent structure, which is to say that however they're sliced, there's no distinction between their canonical parts and their mere parts. Here's yet another way to put this. An icon is a homogeneous kind of symbol from both the syntactic and the semantic point of view. Each of its parts, ipso facto, gets a semantic interpretation in the same way the picture principle interprets all of them, all of the parts. But none of this is true of discursive representations. Only a specifiable subset of the parts of a discursive representation are syntactic or semantic constituents. It's thus far open that the various constituents of a discursive representation may contribute in different ways to determining the semantics of their hosts. Our paradigms, the sentences of a natural language, are clearly structurally heterogeneous in this sense. Considered syntactically, they contain nouns, verbs, adjectives, noun phrases, verb phrases, prep phrases, and so on. Considered semantically, they contain singular terms, descriptions, predicates, and an apparatus of logical terms like quantifiers, variables, and connectors, and so on once again. Correspondingly, both the rules that distinguish the semantic constituents from the sentential constituents from mere sentential parts and the rules that compose the interpretation of sentential expressions from the interpretations of their constituents turn out to be disconcertingly complex and hard to state. Linguists have thus far had only very partial success in formulating either. Compare the unarcane apparatus that is sufficient to formulate the picture principle. Because they decompose into syntactically and semantically heterogeneous constituents, discursive representations can have logical forms. For all I know, all discursive representations that can express truths do have them. By contrast, they decompose into because they decompose into syntactically and semantically homogeneous parts, iconic representations don't have logical forms. I take that to be truistic. The logical form of a symbol is supposed to make its truistic for the following reason. The logical form of a symbol is supposed to make its compositional structure explicit, namely to make the contribution that each of its interpretable parts contributes to the interpretation of the whole explicit. But every part of an iconic symbol is interpreted, and each part contributes in the same way as each of the others, so effectively there's no logical form to describe. Discursive symbols can represent things that icons are unable to. That's largely because they're semantically and syntactically homogeneous, so their various constituents can contribute in different ways to determining the content of their hosts. Singular terms contribute in one way, predicates contribute in quite another way, and logical constants in still a third, and there's plenty more. But the picture principle says that every part of an icon contributes to its interpretation in the same way it pictures part of what the icon does. In consequence, icons can't express, for example, this is all familiar, I suppose, for example, the distinction between negative propositions and affirmative propositions, which turns, among other things, on distinctions among logical constants. Likewise, they can't express quantified propositions or hypothetical propositions or modal propositions. They can't even, strictly speaking, express predication, since that requires, among other things, distinguishing items that contribute individuals to a semantic interpretation from terms that contribute sets or properties or whatever, depending upon your favorite ontology. For reasons that are quite closely related, whereas discursive representations typically carry ontological commitments, iconic representations don't. In particular, discursive representations do, but iconic ones do not, impose principles of individuation on the domains in which they are interpreted. I don't want to talk about this at any length because I'm scared to. So it would help enormously if you'll just let me assume that what individuals a system of representation is ontologically committed to depends on the apparatus of quantifiers, variables, singular terms, and sortal predicates to which it has access. To a first approximation, but I think only to a first approximation, systems of representation are committed to the individuals over which they quantify. Conversely, if the available representations don't include quantifiers or classifiers or something of that sort, then there won't be principles of individuation for whatever it is that the representations are of. Since iconic representations lack that sort of apparatus, there's no right answer to the question which things or how many things does this iconic symbol represent. I think Quine said something of that sort. I hope he did. I'd like for a change to be in respectable company. To be sure, a photograph may show three giraffes in the veldt, but it likewise shows a family of giraffes and an odd number of Granny's favorite creatures and a number of Granny's favorite odd creatures and a piece of the veldt that's inhabited by any or all of these. No doubt, we usually can agree about how to interpret the ontology of such a photograph. We do so in light of whatever project we happen to have in hand. But that's not the relevant consideration for present purposes. What matters to us is that the discursive symbol, three giraffes in the veldt, in quotes, specifies a scene relative to such concepts as three giraffes in the veldt, and so on. A fortiori, a mind that lacks these concepts can't use that symbol to represent the scene. Contrast iconic representations, you can, of course, see three giraffes in the veldt without having the concept giraffe or the concept of veldt or whatever. Nor do you need those concepts to make a picture of three giraffes in the veldt. A camera and film will suffice. Equivalently, more or less, the context iconically represents is like the context see, describe, points at, and photographs. All are transparent to substitution of coextensive descriptions. But discursively represents is like sees as and describes as. It always has an opaque reading, which, in fact, it usually prefers. Excuse me. According to RTM, that's because seeing as and describing as, like other acts of conceptualization, operate by subsuming distal things under the concept that is expressed by the predicate of some mental representation. It's entirely in the spirit of RTM that conceptualizing and predicating are two ways of talking about much the same thing. Okay, that's all the premises we need. Brief review. We started with conceptualized versus unconceptualized representations. We swapped that for representing as versus representing tout court, which we then swapped for iconic versus discursive representation. This allowed us to swap the question whether there are unconceptualized mental representations, in particular whether there's a perceptual given, for the question whether any mental representations are iconic. I then suggested that because they lack logical form, iconic representations don't provide principles of individuation for their domains of interpretation. This suggests a final metamorphosis. Are there unconceptualized representations become, are there mental phenomena in which representation and individuation are dissociated? If there are, then that's prima facie evidence of non-conceptual mental representation. Well, is there such evidence? To begin with, if you want to test a theory, you need what used to be called correlating definitions. Correlating definitions were supposed to be, back in the days when everybody was a positivist, things that linked truths that or definitions or stipulations or something that linked theoretical terms with experimentally observable phenomena. So you need what used to be called correlating definitions. Here's one. It's a rule of thumb that all else equal, the, as one says, psychological complexity of a discursive symbol, for example, the amount of memory it takes to store it or to process it, is a function of the number of individuals whose properties it independently specifies. I'll call this, as psychologists do in effect, the item effect. Consider, as it might be, phone books. They specify properties of individuals, their numbers and addresses, and they are explicit as to both the individuals and the properties. All sorts of things follow. The phone books of big cities are generally bigger than the phone books of small cities, and they take up more shelf space, and it takes longer to look up an arbitrary number in a big phone book than in a small one, and it's harder to memorize or even to copy the contents of a big phone book than that of a small one, and so forth. This is all because the representations in phone books are discursive, hence conceptualized. They presuppose the possession and employment of such concepts as X's number is Y, phone P has the number N, and so forth and so on. Lists, like sentences, are paradigms of discursive representation. They exhibit effects of their content, so it's the number that's listed for John that you proceed to dial in consequence of looking his number up, and they also exhibit effects of the number of items they specify. Compare photographs. A photograph of 60 giraffes takes no more space in your album or on the screen if you project it than a photograph of 6 giraffes. For that matter, it takes no more space than a photograph of, whoops, that will be the end of the lecture. There, let me just read the sentence again. Compare photographs. A photograph of 60 giraffes takes no more space in your album or on the screen than a photograph of 6 giraffes. For that matter, it takes no more space than a photograph of no giraffes, the one that you made when you forgot to take the lens cap off. Photographs are time sensitive. Very old ones are generally more degraded than very new ones, but they aren't item sensitive. This is hardly surprising in light of the preceding discussion. Iconic representations don't individuate. They don't represent individuals as individuals. A fortiori, nothing about them depends on the number of individuals that they represent. Some data at last. Can we find in the perceptual psychology literature indications of a mode of representation that exhibits typical effects of iconicity, in particular a mode of representation that fails to yield an item's effect? If we can, then it's in the cards that such representations are unconceptualized, hence that there is a perceptual given. In fact, relevant examples are the stock and trade of inter-level Cogsci texts. The basic idea is that perceptual information undergoes several sorts of processes, typically in a more or less serial order, in the course of progress from representations on the surface of a transducer, say on the retina, to representations in long-term memory. Some of the earliest of these processes operate on representations that are stored in an so-called echoic buffer, so-called echoic buffer, EB from here on, and these representations are widely believed, as a matter of fact, to be iconic. Two consequences of their presumed iconicity should be stressed, since both suggest possible experimental investigations. First, Since iconic representations are unconceptualized by definition, they do not individuate items that they represent. So items in EB, in the echoic buffer, oughtn't produce items effect, item effects. Second, representations, that is, in the echoic buffer oughtn't to produce items effects. That is, their complexity or something oughtn't to vary with the number of individuals that they specify. Second, as considered, since they're unconceptualized, quasi-unconceptualized, iconic representations can't express properties whose recognition requires perceptual inferences. So in the case of vision, icons register the sort of properties that photographs do, two-dimensional shape, shading, color, and so forth, but not, as one says, object properties like being an animal or a fortiori being a cat belonging to Granny. Correspondingly, in the case of auditory perception, icons in the echoic buffer should register the sort of properties that show it in a speech spectrogram, frequency, amplitude, duration, and so on, but not whether the distal sound is a rendering of Lily Bolero. For present purposes, if you've turned up a mental representation that doesn't individuate and isn't inferred, that's good reason to think that what you've turned up is an icon. Bearing all that in mind, let's start with an anecdote by way of building intuitions. So there I am, seated at the keyboard, working hard on a piece for Mind and Language or whatever. At the moment, I vacillate between a semicolon and a comma. A clock begins to chime. Chime, 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 the clock says. At first I ignore this, but then it seizes my attention. I wonder what it may be, O clock, I say to myself, it being my habit to address myself in a sort of pig Georgian. What happens next is the point of interest. I commence to count the chimes, including the ones that I hadn't previously noticed. Strikingly, so anyhow the phenomenology goes, it's not just that I say to myself, there have been three chimes so far, rather it's that I count the chimes that I hadn't till now attended to. One chime, two chimes, three chimes, I think, thereby subsuming each chime under the sortal concept, a chime. Four more chimes follow, and I duly add them to get the result. I think it must be 6:30. The clock in the hall runs half an hour fast. Notice that one's ability to do this trick is time-bound. It lasts only for perhaps a second or two, so you can't count the unattended chimes that you heard yesterday. A psychologist might well conclude, in fact, they typically do, there's a brief interval during which an iconic, hence unconceptualized, representation of the chiming is held in the echoic buffer. Within this interval, you can conceptualize, hence individuate, hence count, the chimes more or less at will. After that, the trace decays, and you've lost your chance. I think he'd probably be right to so conclude, and I think that in so concluding, he would thereby postulate a perceptual given. Prima facie objections. There are several, but let me just mention a couple. First one would say, but look, clearly there is an item limit on the echoic buffer. You may be able to count two or three chimes retrospectively, but I'll bet you can't do 15. First reply in passing, temporal effects can mimic item's effects, so they need to be controlled for. Suppose representations in EB last 2 seconds, and it takes the clock 60 seconds to chime 15 times. Then you will, as it were, lose the last last 11 chimes in such a sequence. At least you will if I've done the arithmetic right. This is not, however, an effect of the number of stimulus items that can be stored in the buffer. It's just an interaction between the temporal duration of the stimulus and the temporal capacities of the memory. Second reply, more interesting. It's not because the buffer is item limited that you can't count 15 chimes retrospectively. Rather, it might be said, once you control for the rate of temporal decay, it seems that how much you can put in the buffer is actually relatively unconstrained. It's not that representing of many chimes that's hard, it's the counting of them. For counting requires individuation, and individuation requires conceptualization, and it's independently plausible, the conceptualizing costs. There are data that suggest this, in fact a lot, suggest that this is indeed the right diagnosis. Some of the most convincing and well-known ones come from a famous series of experiments that George Sperling did way back in 1960. These findings are richer than I have space to summarize, but they support a pervasive phenomenological intuition, quoting Sperling. When complex stimuli consisting of a number of letters are tachistoscopically presented, that is, presented for a very short interval, observers enigmatically insist that they have seen more than they can remember. That is, more than they can report. In the experiment, again to quote Sperling, the observer behaves as though the physical stimulus were still present when it's not, that is, after it's been removed, and his behavior in the absence of the stimulus remains a function of the same variables of visual stimulation as in its presence. That's to say, brightness of the stimuli, how discriminable they are, and so on. The critical experimental finding, no longer quoting Sperling, the critical experimental finding was that if queried just after the stimulus was turned off, though the subject could report only three of the letters he'd seen, he could report any three of them. So it appears there is a very short-term visual memory of which the capacity is at a minimum considerably greater than what the subject is able to read out of it. Apparently, it's the cost of conceptualizing information in the memory rather than the number of items that the memory contains that bounds the subject's performance. That's the way Sperling reads the results, and it's the standard reading. Notice that though the Sperling results argue that the content of representations in the echoic buffer is unconceptualized, these representations must, of course, have content. In particular, they must contain a content from which the categorization of an unattended stimulus, for example, a count of the chimes, can be recovered. That they do so is crucial to explaining, after all, why the subject is accurate more often than chance. But equally, the content they contain mustn't be conceptual content, since if it were, then there ought to be an items effect, which apparently there isn't. The long and short is, if what is given is what's unconceptualized but semantically evaluable, but has content, it's thus far plausible that representations in the echoic buffer are given. But I do want to emphasize the thus far part. The argument I've set out is empirical through and through. It rather suggests that there is iconic representation in perception, but it doesn't demonstrate that there is. Demonstrations are ever so much nicer than suggestions, of course. Their level of confidence is so much higher. But there isn't one either pro or con in the present sort of case, nor will there be. Since the issue about what kinds of mental representation there are is empirical, so too are the considerations that resolve it. I also want to emphasize that Sperling's study, though particularly elegant, is only one of a plethora of straws in the wind, all of which appear to be blowing in much the same direction. If you like, I can recount some other very similar experimental results that concern other perceptual modes like audition. Effects of content without items effects, that is, of representation without individuation, are actually quite easy to find when you know where to look. I wonder why so many philosophers are resistant to looking there. Conclusion. I think that there is quite likely a perceptual given. In any case, it would seem that the issue is empirical, so whether there's a given is, to that extent, no philosopher's business. On the other hand, if in fact there is a given, that should be a professional concern to philosophers who argue a priori that there can't be one, that all content has to be conceptualized. Those philosophers are now required to sketch an alternative explanation of the sorts of empirical findings I've been gesturing toward. I am not holding my breath. But does it matter philosophically in any other way? Does it in particular matter to epistemology? I have two reflections, both of which return us to considerations I raised at the beginning of the paper. First, epistemological reflection. If the given is supposed to be what ultimately grounds explicit justifications of perceptual inferences, then it must be both non-inferential and introspectable, as indeed foundationalist epistemologies have generally assumed. But then the empirical evidence is very strongly that there is no given. It seems to be a sort of iron law, one that holds in just about every case, or every case I've heard of anyhow, that what can be introspected is always the product of inference, though the inferences are, of course, typically subpersonal and encapsulated. Contrapositively, what's a plausible candidate for not being inferred is almost never available to introspection. For example, and I think this is a central consideration in this area, all the perceptual representations that are accessible to consciousness exhibit constancy effects. And by pretty general consensus, constancy effects are the products of unconscious inferences. This includes the kind of mental representations that were traditionally offered as candidates for being sense data. You can't, for example, see the retinal color of a thing, that is, the color of the light that the thing actually reflects to the eye, and hence that the eye actually registers. Inferences that correct for background distance, illumination, and so forth are automatic, mandatory, and prior to introspective access. You see oranges as orange, not as oranges, but as orange. Even when the light is dim, that's because what you see is the retinal color as corrected for the effects of the intensity of the ambient illumination. Such considerations suggest pretty strongly, I think, that the given doesn't do what foundationalist epistemology wants it to. It doesn't provide a kind of representation that is both insensitive to conceptual bias and available for conscious report. Well, if that's what the given turns out, well, if what's given turns out not to support a certain kind of epistemology, that, of course, doesn't argue against there being a given. It just argues against that kind of epistemology. I wonder sometimes whether our epistemology has quite caught up with the Freudian revolution in psychology. There is every sort of evidence that a great deal of the reasoning involved in the fixation of quotidian perceptual belief is unconscious, hence unavailable for report by the reasoner. That being so, the residual options for epistemology are to say either that most of our perceptual beliefs are unjustified, or that much of what justifies our perceptual beliefs isn't conscious. I'm unclear that it matters, that very much turns on which of these epistemology chooses. Second, epistemological reflection. It's often suggested, especially by philosophers in the Sellars tradition, like Brandom, McDowell, and Davidson, in Davidson at least in some of his moods, that unconceptualized representation can't be what grounds perceptual judgments. That's supposed to be because justification is a relation among contents, and whatever is unconceptualized thereby lacks content. The putative consequence of this putative truth are horrific. They include the principled impossibility of a naturalized epistemology. Indeed, the principled isolation of the realm of causes from the realm of reasons, quite generally. Thus, McDowell says that causal explanations of perceptual judgments of the kind that psychologists seek for can at best provide, as he puts it, exculpations where we wanted justifications. This is, to be sure, a long issue, but I do hate a priori arguments that such and such a kind of discourse can't be naturalized, and realm talk makes my skin crawl. So I can't resist a couple of brief comments. First, discussions about whether any representational content is given shouldn't just take for granted that all content is ipso facto, conceptualized. Not if, as I've been trying to convince you, there's a plausible case for preconceptual iconic representation. On that assumption, the putative truism that justification is a relation among the contents of representation does not entail that justification is a relation among conceptualized contents of representations. According, the question that needs settling is whether the content of an unconceptualized representation might be the datum that grounds, that is, makes rational, a perceptual judgment. Well, I'm damned if I see why not. A picture of three graphs of giraffes in the veld carries information about there being three giraffes in the veld. Carries information about is extensional, so the picture carries all sorts of other information too. But somebody who has the concepts, giraffe, three, and veld, and so on, and only somebody who has those concepts, I think, is in a position to extract the information about there being three giraffes that the picture carries. It's his exercising of those concepts that enables him to see the picture as carrying the information that there are three giraffes. Accordingly, his reason for believing that there were three giraffes is precisely that the picture shows three of them. His reason, notice, not his mere exculpation. As far as I can see, none of that is under threat from the consideration that judgment requires conceptualization. Judgment requires conceptualization, even if, as I suppose, representation doesn't. And of course, there's no conceptualization without concepts. The question how, for example, by what inferential processes, iconic representations might get conceptualized is, of course, very hard, and the answer is unknown for practically any of the interesting cases. On the way of looking at things that I've been trying to tell you, that's a large part of what the psychology of perception is about. So then, as far as I can see, there's nothing to preclude a story about how iconically carried information might function to ground a perceptual judgment. Ground, not just cause. I note in passing, this really is inside, I note in passing that I also know of no reason why such a story must assume that the required concepts are constituted, even in part, by rules for their application to iconic representations, or indeed that they are constituted even in part by any rules for applying them. There aren't, I should think, any criteria for applying the concept giraffe to giraffes, which is to say that the perceptual perceptual inferences about giraffes don't have to be grounded in a priori semantic truths. I take this, in fact, to be a virtue of the story that I've been telling, since I think the lack of criteria for applications of non-logical terms is pretty plausible on independent grounds. I'll end with a two-line methodological homily. I don't see that the epistemology of perception can simply ignore the empirical question how perception works. Quite generally, justifying a belief can't require a thinker to do such and such unless the thinker has the kind of mind that can do such and such. It can't, for example, require him to introspectively access the preconceptual ground of his beliefs unless he has the kind of mind that can introspectively access the preconceptual grounds of its beliefs. I've heard it said that how perception works doesn't matter to epistemologists because theirs is a normative rather than a descriptive enterprise. But how could one be bound by norms that one is, in point of nomological necessity, unable to satisfy? And what's the conceivable interest, even to epistemologists, of norms that don't bind us? Thank you.
Easy question from the gentleman in the white shirt.
Well, I wonder how the kind of propositionality that iconic names have explains the statistic rather than the
product. They're trivially systematic. I mean, anybody who, as it were, grasped any of the representations can grasp all of the others. They're in that sense, in that sort of vacuous sense, far more systematic than say, discursive representations. The point about a discursive representation being systematic is roughly that some but not all the well-formed streams have interpretations, that the interpretations are of semantically related strings can be syntactically different. but in the case of pictures, every sequence of parts has an interpretation, a fortiori, some of them do, and that's all the systematicity requires. So you can take, a little piece from here and a little piece from down there and make a picture out of them, put them together, concatenate. And what you'll have is a picture of this part of the guy and that part of the guy. They're all interpretable.
But I thought phenomenon you want to explain, the specificity phenomenon was that there are various different things that the picture can do that are systematically related. With a picture, you just have one picture you can represent. How does that give you two different things?
The basis of systematicity is a claim that if a complex representation has a certain interpretation, then there'll be another complex representation that has a related interpretation. Okay, that's trivially true in the case of an icon. So you can interpret these two adjacent items, say, and the fact that they have an interpretation at all allows you to predict that some other two adjacent items will have an interpretation. So they're systematic, but not many. I mean, it's simply a banal consequence of the picture principle that they're systematic.
Gentleman in the front row.
Icons, according to you, don't have
That's what I'm trying to say, yeah.
And they don't have
well, that depends on, I mean, I'm perfectly happy. I'm sort of assuming that pictures are very often of things. That is, in that sense, they have referential content.
Well, I want to ask about this, in the sense that they don't need
Right.
Then, I put it proper in contained content, per se. So right. This is the press, what I'd like to ask you on what is the nature of this given?
Yeah, well. Right. Right.
But I'm not sure what kind of content that's supposed
to be. Okay, I'm not in this paper, though I got a story to tell about that. It's not a very convincing story. I'm not trying to give an account of the metaphysics of content. I mean, whatever it is, it is. But the question, in what sense does an iconic representation carry information about giraffes? Has a straightforward answer, that is, somebody who has the concept giraffes can recover that information from the picture. That's the sense that matters for iconic representation. Now, you can ask, aha, what is the metaphysics of an object such that, it's a complicated question, such that an individual has the right concepts can recover certain information from the representation? And that's the question I don't know, maybe answer it.
One follow-up.
I in a sense that doesn't mean you can't recover information. It depends on which side of the fence is being head lifted. My recovery of information from this side of the fence after a course.
Well, it depends on what you take Davidson's principle to be. I read him, in a certain sense I don't care, obviously, but I'm reading him literally. He says only what's conceptualized can be a justification. I say that's simply not true. What may be true is that only what's conceptualizable can function as a justification. But that's of no interest. I mean, almost practically everything carries information about vast amounts of stuff. So all that's required in the iconic representation of three giraffes is that it should carry information about three giraffes. It also carries information about their spatial position and how many trees there are, all sorts of other stuff.
Nick Comfort.
I suppose we look beyond the case of visualization. You're looking for example of another section. In the case of the poem, the studio, the same world doesn't change. You're looking at just a little bit, it's sort of there. But actually, nothing is there as it. Apart from recognizing the contentions. And it seems to be really difficult to know if you can also do something like this, but it's not in another sense. Because these people cannot. As a way of coming to have concepts, I've never had a national college teaching them, they still can't do it. So it's an interesting case where it's apparently there for them, but actually it can't for them. This is where the government is going to set the
Well, there are two different issues, about one of which I'm a bit sensitive. If the right story about these guys is that they have information available, sensory information in some sense or other, that they can't conceptualize, then that's fine for my, that's grist for my mill. They say philosophers are people who scratch their ears like that. It seems to me going that far around the bush to make the point that people have sensory information, I mean, who needs agnosia. There's plenty of arguments just from the almost intuitive data. What I'm a little sensitive by is the assumption that any of this has anything to do with how people acquire concepts. There's a very, I mean, it may have something to do with how people acquire words, of course, I mean, but that's, from my point of view, not much interest because you can only acquire the word if you already have the concept, so the problem becomes how do you acquire concepts. And from, I mean, that's a very long story. If anybody wants to stay till about midday tomorrow, I'll tell you how I think it runs. It's a very long story, but I don't think, what it ends up by saying is, look, in the sense that people have in mind what they when they think about or talk about conceptual learning, there just isn't any such thing. Probably because there isn't any such thing as learning, though I consider that to be slightly tendentious, but the first part seems to be just self-evident. On the other hand, it's one of those self-evident truths which require a lot of explication before they reveal their self-evidence. So it's a long story, but that's I would be very dubious about somebody who claimed that a certain kind of pathology blocks your capacity
other, which would otherwise be intact, to learn new concepts, because I don't think you have any such capacity. Again, it's a long story. I don't take it, I don't see, I mean, I'm not supposing that you, your response should be, damn, why didn't I think of that? I mean, why haven't I noticed that? It requires a lot of talking, but I think it's true.
Gentleman to the right.
Looks plainly what?
Sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, to answer that at all usefully, if I were able to, would require looking at these issues about the metaphysics of content. Bufferized information, because it's not conceptualized, has all sorts of funny properties, like it can't be, in a certain sense, misinformation, though it can be misleading information, blah, 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 usual stuff. So, yeah, I want to, at the end of all this, not today, but at the end of, you know, the millennium or something, to end up telling a story about buffered information that is essentially informational. And having said that, then I don't care whether you say, well, it's not really information unless it's conceptualized. The point is, not just anything is such that a person with the appropriate concepts can recover from it the information that there were three giraffes. That makes what's in the buffer very different from what's in the chair or something.
Ron Chrisley, and then Barry Smith, and then Lizzie Fricker.
Thanks for that. I'm very sympathetic with where you're trying to get, but I want to make a remark. Let me put it in bad news, good news. So first, bad news. Bad news is, I think, on your notion of concept is so minimal that there isn't any room left over for something to be extra conceptual or unconceptualized, and yet play the role that we need to get in to play in the justificatory enterprise.
Why is that?
And the reason why I think that is, I think that, as you quite rightly point out, your notion of the extra conceptual or the unconceptualized doesn't represent as, and yet I think not a mere informational relationship isn't sufficient to provide a justification relationship. It must be representing as. But that's where the good news comes in. The good news is that the people you're arguing against have such a restricted, or such a, what should I say, beefy notion of what a concept is, that there's plenty of room on the other side of representing as, but before you get to what they mean by concept possession, or what a concept is conceptualized, for you to make your point in that area, rather than on trying to do it on the other side of this very low hurdle of what a concept is. So I think it's, you should help yourself to representing as, matter of fact, you need to, in order to get the other part of the justification exercise going, and not be afraid that you instantly, by definition, put yourself into the realm of concept as
right,
say, the DAO or whoever understands it.
Right, okay. Now, I'm of course, I don't think my notion of concept is incorrectly exiguous. I think it's exactly right. I mean, it's because of that saying. But I don't see why, for these purposes, I need more than I'm independently prepared to give myself. Look, it's not a quirk, it's not an accident, that from certain pictures, certain iconic representations or whatever, you can recover information about giraffes, and from other ones, you can't. That makes it representational, or dispositionally representational, or something, in a way that mere objects in the world are not. That's what I care about. Now, I also think it's independently plausible, or not insane, that you can have that kind of representation, as it were, purely mechanically, causally in some sense or other, and that anything that goes, and also independently plausible, not stipulated, that anything, any richer notion of information brings in a whole flock of things like representing as, conceptualization, all that sort of stuff. I think that's a natural division, whether you call it a division of representation or not, I don't mind. But I think there's a natural sense in which something symbolic is going on both sides of that division. And I want to hold on to there being something symbolic, something that's representational in some sense. And I'll say what sense. It's the sense that you can, if you have the right concepts, recover that information. If you don't like representational, then what I'm trying to actually avoid in detail saying things that are obviously preposterous is I like to distinguish between information, between registering information and representing things. So registration versus.
So I think registration does involve a notion of has a spectral shape. It is representative.
I don't see why.
I think that's necessary for the.
Good. Let me ask a question.
Because although the near information, you want concept judgment, you want something to judge that something is read, certainly when only when there is information there that it's read, but you also don't want them to be required to judge something's read if the information is there, but the rule isn't presented as being as contained read.
Okay, one question, one answer.
Okay, look, this is this is going to end up being a complicated business. They're not, I mean, one isn't, of course, required to represent something as red because it, as it were, looks red because it produces red sensations. But I have the following puzzle, which I think ought to worry the kind of position you're talking about. Look, you can see red, you can detect redness, even if you don't have a concept. You can't detect giraffeness unless you have a concept. Now, that's a great gulf fixed, and it's got to be honest. If there is some sort of representation involved in seeing red, it better not be conceptualization. Not if you want to say, as at least empiricists want to say, that that you learn the concept red from experiences that are as of red. So, I mean, I don't want to say that. I don't think you learn the concept at all. I mean, it's all just loose talk. But the point is, there are many kinds of perceptual engagements that you can have with red things that don't require the concept. That makes red quite different from giraffes. So now the question is, what does require the concept? Well, seeing it as red.
I want to follow Ron's
example of the
Adam
Smith. I guess good news for you is that because you separate iconic and discursive representations, you don't like it in isolation against the inside picture theory and the tractatus, so that applies to your heart.
Yeah, right. Well, it's not that one is lacking arguments in that area.
The bad news is that it might be kind of disappointing. You wanted to talk about one of the parts of the idea of the iconic representation will be subpersonal, will be outside consciousness, but that makes you sound very much like
okay, but now, right, good. But now, for one thing, I think it can't be, it just can't be, that introspectable sensory states are non-conceptualized. Not for the McDowell-Davidson kind of reason, but simply because, for the reason I said, they exhibit mandatory constancy and constancy and constancies in inferential process. So there's just no hope of having something which has the property of being both unconceptualized and introspectively available. So in that sense, given there isn't going to be one. But I think you're being too kind to Davidson and McDowell, which is not hard to do. You're supposing that what they're claiming is, that what the central claim is, that whatever is, that what... You're supposing that what their central claim is whatever is conscious is ipso facto conceptualized, and I think that's right, though, as I say, for the wrong reason. But I think the essential claim is that what's ever unconceptualized can't play the role of, as it were, a premise, roughly speaking, in a justificatory object, in a justificatory argument. And that's what I want to deny. That is, I want to say it's perfectly clearly part of the justification, taking pictures as icons, part of the justification that there was, of your belief that there were three giraffes in the belt or whatever, that the picture shows them shows a scene in which there are three giraffes in the belt. It doesn't follow from that, of course, that what shows that is in some sense itself conceptualized, right? So the picture, you want me to justify my belief, I say, well, look at the picture, you see, it shows three giraffes. But the picture, so it's a property of the representation that plays a role, a central role in the justification, but the representation isn't conceptualized. You don't need, sorry, yeah. Very quickly.
So expensive, it'd be kind of strange that
you were. That's right. Yeah. It does look like an iron, but it's not. And in fact, I mean, the non-existent book of which this is an object contains a fragment contains a lot of discussion of the pollution stuff because it's essential to all sorts of claims I want to make. But what's going on there, it's independently, I think, pretty clear, is not that there's an items effect, but rather that you have independent parallel processors, and you only have a fixed number of those. Now, that's not an effect of how many items there are. That's an effect of how many registers, roughly speaking, you have. And it's a non-trivial claim, of course, that that parallel processing is going on in the case of the pollution experiment, but it's a claim that, in fact, pollution makes, as he says, look, God gives you four registers or seven or whatever it is this week, and they operate independently. You can assign each one to a dot, or each one can grab a dot, and the result is when each one has its proprietary dot, you can't do any more vis-a-vis the dots. But that's not because there are seven dots, it's because there are seven registers for them. It's a constraint on the number of blackboards you have, not on the items you can write on them.
Lizzie Fenner. Oh yeah, yes, sure. Yeah, sure it is. Sure. Maybe it isn't, but I'm assuming, I mean, taking for granted that we're operating within an appropriate notion of grain. So, of course, the atoms don't have an interpretation, but they'll be, roughly speaking, perceptually available parts, perceptually interpretable parts, and their however, you know, one, I mean, I don't mind that we can't see very, very, very small things, but those things follow the picture principles. That is, everything, to put it very crudely, everything that gets interpreted at all gets interpreted by the picture principle. Some things don't get interpreted at all because they're too small, or because they're too big, or because your eyes are closed, or whatever. Yeah.
So, is there a substantial interest in the principle there? Because it seems to me that the parts of the
I think
there
is.
Except when they are. Yeah, but I mean, some of
them. Oh, no. I mean, look, it's perfectly reasonable, I would have thought, to say, look, consider the perceptually discriminable, in the case of paintings or something, there's not only the perceptually discriminable parts, but in fact the parts here intended to attend to. I mean, it's all okay with me. But can take the perceptually discriminable parts. If they have interpretations at all, then their interpretation will be in accordance with the picture principle. If something isn't a perceptually discriminable part, or it doesn't have an interpretation at all, it's just a hole in the canvas or something, then it doesn't have, then of course it doesn't satisfy the picture principle.
So, is the picture effect
No.
System.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm not supposing that that all pictures, in fact, I mean, a visit to the Guggenheim Museum will convince you of the contrary, that all principles, that all pictures are represent anything or intended to represent anything or whatever. Just if it's a picture, if it has an interpretation in terms of some semantic property like refers to or stands for or something, then the picture principle will tell you how it's interpreted. Like the rest of this paper, I didn't intend the picture principle to be interesting. I mean, it begs all the significant questions, just as you say. Still, it's good enough to, I think, to highlight something that really matters. That is, that being the kind of symbol a sentence has, and in particular the kind of symbol that has logical form, requires constituent structure. And I'm inclined to guess, I mean, this is just a guess, but I'm inclined to guess that that everything you do to that kind of symbol, say everything you do to language, is sensitive to its constituent structure and essentially nothing else. So that's really the important fact about discursive representations, that they have constituents, and that fact, iconic representations, never satisfy.
Lady in the second row, and then Mike Martin.
I'm wondering whether there could be any relationship between iconic representation and modes of presentation, say, thinking in your theory of concepts.
And what?
Modes of presentation.
Oh. Yeah. I think I want to do pretty much what Kant wants to do. That is, I don't think of sensations as modes of presentation. I think of modes of presentation. I think to be a mode of presentation, you have to present what you present as something. And so if that's right, and if all this story is right, then only what's conceptualized counts as a mode of presentation. I mean, not that the distinction is all that clear. But I do think that the notion of intentionality and the notion of a mode of presentation run together. And if you mean by intentionality failures of substitution, that is, you can't substitute semantic equivalent description, then sensations aren't intentional by that criterion. A sensation of red is a sensation of everything, you know, is also a sensation of the chair and so forth and so on. If that's your criterion for intentionality, then modes of presentation run with intentionality, which according to this argument means they run with conceptualization. Trouble is, I mean, I think the insight that underlies thinking that the notion of intentionality and the notion of mode of presentation are really sort of interdefined, I think that's right, and I think that's a deep insight. But what connects with that isn't so clear. I think conceptualization does, but of course, if you're afraid, you don't think that.
I asked the question because it occurred to me that all the modes of presentation, present the content of concept as the
right
stuff of which modes of presentation themselves maybe is not present in a representing as form. I mean, that it's not actually.
Well, you don't have. I mean, you don't represent your representations except in philosophy classes. I assume that they're probably, I mean, I assume that that mental representations are made out of neurons or whatever neurologists believe in. But that's not, I mean, that's not part of this kind of story. This kind of story is in that sense functional.
Mike Martin.
Functional. Yeah.
Sorry, this is just a follow-up to the reason. There are problems. Slight question about how we specify the question of brain.
Think of
pictures of the sort or some of the early pop art, some of the literature, where the zip blown up newspaper photograph.
Yeah.
So
there's
in terms of the brain, that's supposed to the dots that we're actually using, so the little dots.
Yeah.
And of course there are parts of the picture which are interpreted on their own, which are
right.
Part of the picture.
Right, but I don't think it's an icon either. That is, I don't think it's a pic. I have to be careful of this. It's a mixed icon. It wants to represent at the same time as it might be this microphone and a dot picture of this microphone. Right, so it doesn't follow the, I mean, it's like It's a bit like a map with things that say there be monsters here or something of that sort written in. It's a mixed mode of representation, so it won't satisfy any straightforward uniform principle of interpretation, and that's supposed to be the joke insofar as you find these things amusing. I mean, you know that you're supposed to see them not only as pictures of microphones or whatever, but as a certain kind of picture of microphones, mainly the ones in which you can resolve the dots.
Sure. I mean, that's something that makes
sense.
One can imagine someone who just wanted to reproduce a photograph.
Yeah, sure.
That means they have, were of the form of using iconic representations or something else, but they're presented at such a scale that when you first look at them, you can blank out what the elements are.
But that wouldn't, I mean, maybe that's right, but it doesn't answer the question, what are the representing elements?
Well, I take it the way you first look at it, you manage to focus in such a way that you get a grouping phenomenon, so you see the initial representation. Still, when we isolate the elements of it, they may still be perceptible, they won't get the grouping.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So they'll count as part, in one sense, as part of the picture, they'll count as part of the picture, and another.
Yeah.
That's why I said it's an issue about the way.
Yeah, you're wanting to take the picture principle seriously, and I advise against that. But on the other hand, it's only a first approximation to say you should take it psychologically. That is, I'm sort of looking at semantics as something like a formal language. So it says, okay, here's a representation. I'll tell you in the first place what its interpretable parts are, roughly that's what the syntax does, and then I'll tell you how to interpret them. So you need to say what's to count as the grain. Now, for most purposes, frivolous purposes. It'll do to say, oh, well, it's what's perceptually discriminable. There'll be counterexamples. I don't have a worked out theory of iconicity, and I don't really want one. I just want to gesture toward the importance of constituency.
Marcus DiQuinto.
I have a question about your argument for including that whole conscious representation
in theory is conceptual. Yeah. Inferential. Yeah, well, I said that. Yeah, yeah, right.
The argument being that process involved in consciousness are inferential.
Right.
And so if there were a community of outputs, it would have to be conceptual.
Right. Well, but that's question begging. That's just what the issue is. I mean, at least it's question begging if what you mean by saying they have conceptual input requires that they have conscious input. Here's my claim. If you don't, but then what's the reason for thinking that they can't have unconceptualized input in the way I was just suggesting? That is, it's a justificatory argument that the picture shows three giraffes, and that argument waves its hands in the direction of the picture. It's something about the picture and something that the picture doesn't conceptualize. The form, the icon itself doesn't, the representation itself is not a conceptualized representation in the way that a sentence might be. So it's carrying information about giraffes. We appeal to such information routinely. When somebody asks us, why do you believe so-and-so, we say, we point to the picture and say, well, look, it shows so-and-so. We don't require that the picture be a conceptualized display in order to show that. Now, I mean, look, I want to be a philosopher, too, when I grow up. I mean, so it's not philosophers versus anybody else. It's a question of what, if anything, can produce a coherent notion of justification, one that's at least now and then occasionally in contact with the one we carry around. And the one we carry around, I think, clearly, in fact, I'm amazed that the literature doesn't resonate to this, that the one we carry around is clearly one which allows unconceptualized displays which, for example, have no constituent structure, to show that so-and-so, hence to be representation, or at least to show so-and-so. I don't think that, I mean, I'm sensitive about this too. I don't think that's a violation of ordinary, I wouldn't care much if it were a violation of ordinary language, but I think it's a perfectly natural way to talk. And why it isn't a counterexample to all this stuff about the ground of a perceptual justification has to be conceptualized, I don't understand.
Yeah, run over that. Louder?
The given, the representation,
can they be false? No, I mean, there's all sorts of sense, all sorts of interesting semantic properties, including asness, I mean, you know, being representations as, which are properties of conceptualized representations and of no others, and one of them is being a misrepresentation. So all that stuff comes in later than iconic representation. But having said that, iconic representations really do carry information, and the information is such that somebody who has the right concepts can recover the aspects of the icon that are relevant to conceptualization. In fact, can see that in the icon, their dress. Now I'm lost. Concepts are concepts which, firstly, they apply to things in the world like Mr. James, right? In the course of getting the concept cat stuck onto Mr. James, there are various, on my story, on the kind of story I like, transformations of representations that go on. Some of these representations have properties typically assigned to the given, typically thought of as characteristic of the given in particular, being non-inferential and having no constituent structure, and others of them don't, they're post-given. So at some point, I mean, this is, I take it pretty close to, I mean, who knows, but pretty close to the kind of thing that Kant has in mind when he talks about problems of schematization. There's this manifold, and it's given, and it carries, in, and bits of it are such that certain concepts can be correctly applied to it, and other bits are not, and other concepts can't be, and the process of getting from what's immediately given in Kant to the recognition of an object like Mr. James is a process of, among other things, conceptualization. I think, I mean, I don't know what's going on in Kant. I mean, probably, I strongly suspect that nobody does, but including maybe Kant, but roughly speaking, that's the kind of picture I think he has, and if it is, anyway, it's one to which I'm quite sympathetic.
Gentlemen here.
I actually want to point that the non-conception given that you've argued before doesn't seem to be non-conception given that the vowels are against.
Oh, okay. Oh, I think those arguments, they're just terrible arguments. I mean, I think it's a characteristic of the literature that's got hung up on that. That can't be what they were talking about when they talked about the given, because that's already conceptualized on independent grounds. So the fact that there's no question about that you can, as it were, pick out demonstratively more than you can pick out with words seems to be have relation to nothing at all. The interesting claim that I thought they wanted to make is one that understands what's given as whatever it is that grounds perceptual justification, right? And I'm saying if they think that has to be conceptualized, they're wrong on empirical grounds. Okay, so, I mean, and that comes back to saying, look, the picture shows it as having three giraffes. Yeah, but then what does he think the conscious world has anything to do with justification? I mean, but look, that's not, you know, a whole lot of stuff. See, look, something went dreadfully wrong when philosophers got this idea, this terrible idea, that if you did your psychology right, it would give you a theory of justification. That just doesn't turn out to be true if justification is burdened with the kinds of requirements that conscious justification, conscious appeal, is burdened with.
But then there's no reason to think that there's anything to be said about justification by conscious appeal. I mean, there's no reason to think that perceptual justification is generally understandable in that kind of way. Most of the processes, as far as I can see, that go on in that are relevant to perceptual justification are processes defined over non-conscious objects. Now, I mean, you can't just say, I'm not interested in that notion of justification. That is, I'm interested in only the conscious notion, unless you're prepared to argue that there is an interesting notion of conscious justification. Well, epistemology has been going on for some time now, and it certainly hasn't found one. Right? So maybe it just isn't. Maybe if you want a notion of justification, certainly one which connects in any interesting way with the psychology. And by the way, anything which accounts for things like you point to the picture and say, look, it shows three giraffes. If you want that notion of justification, which I think is really the familiar one, then you're going to have to give up the consciousness requirement. Or they're just wrong.
Gentleman over here, and then Derek and Thomas.
In psychology, we make the distinction between psychotic representations and representations in long-term memory,
yeah,
in terms of analog versus categorical.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's right, and I think it's a mistake. I mean, I think, you know, the attempt, well, at least, I mean, as I say, my usage is speculative, but the attempt to characterize iconicity in terms of analogicity, I think doesn't, you know, I mean, you don't have a notion of analogicity if you take that seriously, which will support what you want to do with the notion of iconicity. I think what really underlies the notion of iconicity is it's a kind of representation that doesn't have segmental structure. Now, you know, I mean, that's quasi-speculative, but I sort of guess that that it gives you everything you need, and including in that is everything you need for psychological purposes. Derek?
So I return to the fiction by more interested in the Levi. If you try to nice contain the distinction between Skirt's representation and contrast in terms of the fiction principle and the Skirt's representation, like non-equal
breakdown.
Yeah. Then in response to the previous question, you said that the elements of the pictorial, the iconic representations, weren't just any old bits of the picture, but had to be bits of the picture that were could be seen as themselves pictorial.
Right.
And I wonder if that puts some of the pressure. I mean, maybe it doesn't have a canonical breakdown, but maybe it's less arbitrary than you thought.
Oh, I didn't think it was arbitrary. Well, I don't mind. It's just to say that there aren't that pictures don't have. I mean, you could talk about this in lots of different ways, but it's just to say the pictures don't have constituent structure. That is, if you point to a complex piece of picture, like a substantial piece of a picture, and you ask what are the constituents, the interpretable segments, which build up the interpretation for the whole. There's not going to be, there generally isn't an answer to that in the way that there is an answer to sentences. Right? I mean, it doesn't matter, here's maybe the refined way of putting it, it doesn't matter which bits of the picture you take as constituents as long as they're at the appropriate level of grain or above. It matters very much to the sentence which bits you take as constituents. Some of them won't have interpretations. Okay?
I think it's time for a question from me, which is, what is a splendid paper in philosophy? Well, I want to make my first and only contribution to the psychology of philosophy by saying that a splendid paper in philosophy secures your understanding, and it does this partly by momentum. Slower things drift away from one. We've had a paper with momentum. And secondly, a splendid paper is one which exhibits the logic of philosophy, the clarity of analysis. I don't think there's any other kind of clarity. And consistency and validity. And then thirdly, completeness. And we got it all. We have no need to apply for further details to our local linguistics department. And we needn't stay here, I think, until midday tomorrow. Thirdly, an empirical basis. Psychology has to get into philosophy somehow. And here it is. Number four. Decent paper in philosophy, let alone a splendid one, is baffling. It's got to be baffling if it really counts. And Jerry Fodor is fond of saying he doesn't do the subject of consciousness.
but it's too hard for him. Well, I'm not quite so sure of that. I'm not quite so sure that he is avoiding that subject, that maybe that subject is exactly what he is doing. And fifthly, a really good paper in philosophy gives rise to that rare experience, which is so difficult for the philosophical temperament, of thinking that what you heard just might conceivably be true. And this paper, too, has passed that test. Sixthly, I think it's a given that we have this evening been taken forward in philosophy, a given and not an iconic given. And we thank him for this splendid Royal Institute of Philosophy annual lecture. Thank you.